With that, members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. Good luck to everybody testifying and competing with that. And we are on somewhat of a time crunch this morning because we have to be on the floor at 10, so we're going to try to be done here by 9:50 or 9:53 or so. So with that, Representative Nash, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for coming early in the morning for this informational hearing on 4152. Mr. Chair and members, you've seen the craft beverage industry, wine, beer, and spirits, really has changed the landscape of what consumers want in Minnesota. And what we're hearing today is obviously informational, but we're hearing from interested stakeholders, many of whom are to or from my district, that are in favor of having this conversation about how do Minnesotans have access and where can they purchase these Minnesota-made products. And there are advocates for having it in grocery stores. And I just want to have a really healthy conversation to begin understanding where Minnesotans are. Again, I think the response has been overwhelming for craft spirits, wines, and beer. And I have a number of testifiers and want to let them have the bulk of the time. So, Mr. Chair, I will let them get going.
That sounds good, Representative Nash. Thank you. And before we start with the testifiers, Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you. Representative Nash, can you tell me where in your bill it just says Minnesota-made products would be allowed to be in these places? I believe your bill as written would allow any product.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, line 2.22 to 2.24, Minnesota Distilled Spirits, says authorizes the food retailer to sell malt liquor, wine, and Minnesota distilled spirits.
Representative Hillstrom.
So Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, so to be clear, you're saying malt liquor and wine and then only Minnesota distilled spirits. So it would be anybody's wine and anybody's malt liquor, just Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe that was a drafting error. I want Minnesota malt beverages, Minnesota wine, and Minnesota distilled spirits. So,
Representative Hillstrom.
But that's where it is in the bill.
Good catch. And we appreciate your help with working on the bill.
I'm helping here, Mr.
Chair. Oh, you are. You are. You're helping.
I feel the help. I feel the help.
Representative Ms. Poole, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm here today wearing two hats, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association and President of the Minnesota Marketplace Alcohol Alliance. I am going to keep my comments incredibly brief because we have a lot of folks here in industry that would like to share their thoughts today. But I just appreciate, again, your time to have this discussion. There are many complicated layers in Minnesota's alcohol laws. The bill before you today really does expand the food, adds a food retailer license, gives us the ability to sell strong beer, wine, and Minnesota distilled spirits. It provides the cities the opportunity to manage the licenses. It does not mandate a change to the municipal structure. It simply offers city and retailers the options to best meet their businesses and communities. With that, I honestly am going to turn it over to my folks because I know we are on a tight timetable and I think it's important you hear their voice, not mine, again. So thank you. I'm always happy to stand for questions. I have more comments, but I'll let them get on it.
We appreciate that, and we agree with your sentiment. There are a lot of people that want to testify, so whoever's next, come on up. And if we can, everybody today can try to keep their testimony as brief as possible, it will help more people get up and get the conversation started. And with that, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the tape, and please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. I'm Kim McIntoon. I have with me my son, Jamie McIntoon. Jamie's sister, Jessa, is also part of our company, owners of the company, and she's home watching the shop today. Just a little bit about our company. My great-grandfather started our market in 1900, right at the turn of the century. Don't know exactly when, but best information my grandfather had. When grandfather got married in 1916, great-grandpa said there's not enough business in this town for two of us, so he moved to Waconia in 1917. And we've been there since to celebrate our 100th anniversary. that makes us the oldest grocery company in the state of Minnesota, as researched by the Minnesota Grocery Association. In 2016, we bought two more stores, smaller stores, in the south part of the Twin Cities, Montgomery and Lonsdale. And combined, today we have over 300 employees. We're really involved in all aspects of our community. We support our churches, our schools, the 4-H clubs, and more. For instance, like a few years ago when Ridgeview Medical Center wanted to put in a heart wing with Abbott Northwestern Hospitals, McIntoon's Fine Foods was there to donate $50,000 to get it up and going. Just recently, the Oconee Baseball Association needed a new grandstand to take care of our town team, our Legion teams, the Oconee High School team, Little League teams, and we were there with $25,000 to support them. And just in the last couple of weeks, our local Rotary Club wanted to send all of our Korean and Vietnam War vets to Washington, D.C., and they were short of cash, and McIntoon Fine Foods came up with $10,000 to help get that accomplished. So we do all of those kind of things, plus we really try to work with our food shelves and everything else. And I'm just trying to point out the, how sensitive we are to our communities as retail grocers. But for the last 10 years, we've been doing a golf tournament, for instance, for the Oconee Food Shelf. And this last year, even this last spring now, even with the horrible weather we had, we still raised $19,000 for them. And in the course of the 10 years, we've raised over $107,000. We also do a stuff a truck program for them for the last 15 years, and we've put together 269,000 pounds of food for our Waconia, Nord, Young America, and St. Bonnie food shelves. We've also instituted these same two programs in the last 2 years that we've owned Montgomery and Lonsdale for those food shelves. A grocery is a very competitive business. In the early days of my career, there was no such thing as corporate stores. There wasn't even Cub or Walmart or Target, and now that they are there and they're all in groceries. But when we started out, it was grocers like us, families, Colburn's, Lund's, Byerly's, Kowalski's came along, Miners, all family stores. Now everybody is selling groceries, including Hy-Vee, which is new to our market. Then add to that the Aldi's, the Trader Joe's, the Fresh Times, and let's not forget the Fleet Farms, the Menards, and all the other hardware stores. Then we have the Holiday gas stations and the Walgreens and CVS's, the Quick Trips, the Casey's, and all the C-stores that are selling groceries. And we haven't been able to add too many more things to our mix. None of these competitors ever had to ask you folks if they could sell the products that we built our businesses on or not, but and we need to reinvent and evolve daily to stay relevant to our customers. Now we're asking you to help us provide a product to our customers that our customers want and your constituents want by a 4-to-1 margin, I believe. And Jimmy, you have any further comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and everyone else, there's a lot of challenges in operating a grocery store. I mean, taxes are going up, health care goes up, labor costs are all going up throughout everything. And like my dad mentioned, with the continuing competition that keeps coming, he left out like Blue Apron, who's also competing for the dollar, and Amazon, which is probably the biggest person that we're competing with, and it's just going to get more and more over the years. In Waconia and all over the state, there's also like new local breweries and distilleries and stuff like, and wineries popping up, and we want to be able to help sell their products and things like that. As right now, we partner with the local brewery with selling, well, not selling their alcohol, but we use their beer in our brats, and we have a beer brat and an ultimate brat and several other kinds of brats, which kind of help facilitate or like cross-merchandise, I guess, kind of say with them. We're also looking at doing like a wine brat with one of the local wineries, and we're in the development stage of that. But with all that stuff, it would be nice to be able to have their wines and their beers and all other stuff in store so we could cross-merchandise with that. And I'm assuming that you guys have questions with the restricted stuff on grocery stores being able to sell you know, that kind of stuff. We already have cigarettes and fireworks and pottery that, you know, we do a good job with maintaining, selling, you know, to underage people. So, and also with, we used to sell the 3-2 beer, but with Sunday liquor sales, we have discontinued that because that was really the only day that we were selling.
Mr. Chair, I'll say sadly that there were no samples of the brats brought down here this morning, but we'll work on that next year.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Mr. McAthune, thank you. Nice job. And could you just identify yourself for the tape? We know who you are, but just...
Jamie McAthune.
Thank you. And Representative Caprice had a question for you.
Nope, they answered it.
You got it. Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, thank you. Whoever's... Oh,
Representative... Not of them.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you use cigarettes as the example of how you've done a good job with not selling to minors. Every retail store that I've gone to has have cigarettes behind the counter where there is someone who then cards that person right then and there. Every proposal that I've seen for wine and grocery stores or liquor and other retail establishments do not propose to have it behind the counter, but to have it on the shelf along with every other. What do you think about people's concerns about access, right? That if it's just on the shelf, that young people have access to it.
Prior to us pulling off the 3-2 off of our shelves, we have that on the regular shelf that we're selling to only people of age.
With tobacco, and I'm not sure about 3-2 beer, but I know with tobacco we're always tested out by the government with stings, you know, and they bring in people that are underage, but they look like they're 23, and try to buy tobacco, and we have never failed a sting yet.
And fireworks are also out on the floor, too.
Sorry.
Fireworks are also out on the floor.
Thank you, gentlemen. Whoever is up next, we had Chris Kowalski. Representative David.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is to Mr. Klayman. Is there any compensation for the small mom-and-pop shops and the munis that will be put out of business with this bill?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, there aren't no provisions like that in this draft.
Okay, Representative,
because Mr. Chairman and members, we pass this, every muni and every small mom and pop liquor store is out of business. And we can say, well, it's just Minnesota made and so forth. But that's today. We know where this is headed. So I think we need to have the debate of, do we just shut down munis and small mom-and-pop shops and just market through the grocery stores and the C-stores? Because that's where it's headed, so we could cut a lot of pain and heartache if we are just honest and say, we want to shut down the mom-and-pop shops and the munis. That's what this is about. Let's get it. So I don't know if we can have an amendment to have some compensation to all those small businesses in my district that are put out of business, but that's probably for further discussion, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Representative David's good question. That is for further discussion. We're not moving a bill today. We're just starting the discussion. Ms. Kowalski, welcome to the committee. Please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me be part of this process. I really appreciate the time. Again, my parents started this business in 1983, Jim and Mary Ann Kowalski, so I'm second-generation leader of Kowalski's Markets at this point. And I see us as a mom and pop, quite honestly. We are a small local neighborhood business. We have 11 Kowalski stores that took us 30-some-odd years to build. We have been a good community member. I'm not going to, much like McIntunes, I think that local grocer has just historically been that person or that business that's really engaged with the community, with churches, with schools, we were actually the first retailer to build up the Second Harvest Heartland food program with them. We give them millions of pounds of food every year. So, you know, with that being said, we do need some help as well as a mom and pop with continuing to be competitive in this marketplace. I think allowing ourselves, I sort of see ourselves as a food and beverage purveyor anyway, so I see this as a natural evolution of the Minnesota marketplace for a grocer. I don't know that it's this historical challenge or change. I think it's been happening all over the nation. I think that it just makes sense for Minnesota to get there. To the point of putting mom and pops out of the business, obviously being one of those, that is not our intention. I do not see that that would happen. We have had liquor stores now attached to our grocery stores since 2008. And we had to do that in order to compete and stay relevant. So we're fighting to stay relevant in this competitive landscape just as much as everybody else who owns a business today. And it has, based on what McIntyre says, it is harder and harder. But we're committed to our family organizations, and we want to be here. We want to continue to employ 1,600 people. We're proud of that. And so with that being said, there's been many liquor stores that are in close proximity that are still engaged in business and very successful with us having the addition of liquor stores to our markets. So I guess with all that being said, I'm probably forgetting something. But if you have any questions, please feel free.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Ms. Kowalski. Up next, Dana Glade from Jerry's Foods. Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the attachment of liquor stores to these grocery stores bring up a really good point, and so I want to ask a question about the bill. So people who are attached to grocery stores as a separate business with a separate entrance, if they then bring the liquor inside the grocery store, would the attached liquor store also be bound by this only Minnesota-only product, or would they still get to sell the products they already get to sell?
Representative Hilstrom, I think that depends on the individual legislation. I don't think that's in this legislation, and that would be up for future legislatures to decide. Another friendly amendment. This is going well. Mr. Glade, welcome.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of HF 4152. My name is Dana Glade. I'm the Director of Retail Operations for Jerry's Enterprises. Jerry's owns and operates 21 stores, supermarkets in Minnesota under the Cub Foods, County Market, and Jerry's Foods banners, as well as four Cub liquor stores and one Jerry's wine and spirits store. We employ over 2,800 UFCW union workers in our stores, as well as over 175 bakery union members. We also own two county market stores in Wisconsin, one of which has full-strength beer as well as a full array of wine and liquor within the four walls of the grocery store. We are a community-minded operator. We support United Way in all of our stores and corporately, as well as participating with other Cub food stores, supporting Boys and Girls Clubs, Stamp Out Hunger, the Masonic Hospitals, and other Cub Cares and Cub Kindness programs. We're committed to serving the customers in the wide variety of areas which we serve within the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, suburban and rural areas as well. We strive to provide the ultimate in convenience to our customers with an ever-changing variety of services to meet their needs and to also ensure that we are sustainable and able to stay in business. As an industry, supermarkets have been taking hit after hit from big box stores, club stores, online outlets such as Amazon, as well as non-conventional competitors such as convenience stores, gas stations, home improvement stores, and even farm and home stores. These other channels are selling dry groceries, perishable items, paper, cleaning supplies, and many other categories that have been the mainstay of our business. We have no choice but to continue to diversify our product offerings in order to remain competitive. Our customers now have the ability to purchase alcoholic beverages on liquor stores on Sundays, which is a major step forward in bringing Minnesota up to speed with our neighboring states, as well as the rest of the U.S. As a result, we have experienced additional business in our liquor stores, keeping our customers from having to cross the border on Sundays. However, the states surrounding Minnesota allow strong beer, wine, and spirit sales, putting us at a competitive disadvantage with our neighbors. Having the ability to offer the products our customers want levels the playing field with our neighboring states. Also, online and big box retailer outlets are a looming threat as our ever-changing marketplace. We need to compete. We are no strangers to offering a full array of liquor, wine, and beer, as we are able to have a store within a store in our county market in Wisconsin, Wausau, Wisconsin. We take the responsibility of selling to only of-age customers very seriously. All of our cashiers are prompted to type in an address, or I'm sorry, a date of birth for all age-restricted items. An employee who holds a personal liquor license is on duty at all times. In 21 years, we have never had a citation or infraction related to an underage situation in our stores. Our customers appreciate the convenience, variety, and prices that we're able to offer at this location. Locally, we're responsible in our liquor store operations with biannual meetings, alcohol server training, and independent monthly compliance checks by an outside firm. Compliance is a priority in our liquor stores as well for any age-restricted items in our grocery stores. Our brick-and-mortar stores are at risk. Just look around at other channels that have fallen in our area, whether it's toy stores, clothing stores, and such. Alternative competitors are taking a bite out of our business. An opportunity for us to sell and expand our offerings mean a chance for our survival and growth in locations, including cities with municipal liquor stores. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to appear today. Any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glade. We've got a couple of questions. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is either to the testifier or Representative Nash. I agree wholeheartedly with Representative Davids. This is a death knell to the single-family liquor store. You know, we pretty much dealt them a real tough setback last year when we passed Sunday sales, and I was part of that. But this is going, in my opinion, way, way, way too far. And I don't want my child to come up to a convenience store, get gas, and go into a store where there might be somebody that is drunk or acting up, trying to buy spirits in what has traditionally been a very, very safe atmosphere. And as far as Jerry's Food is concerned, obviously I'm very well aware of you. I think you guys do a great job. I think the grocers in all do a great job. But this is not the right bill to help your business. In fact, this goes against small businesses in a really, really horrific way and will result in hundreds, if not thousands, of mom-and-pop liquor stores closing. And so, you know, to me, Representative Davids, you're right on. You know, this is just going too far, too fast, and I want to support those mom-and-pop stores.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Representative Anderson.
I apologize if you said this earlier, Representative Nash, but what happens in a situation where a grocery store is open for 24 hours? Are the food retailers then bound by the hours that we have for liquor sales? Can you tell me how that would work?
Representative Nash.
Say that again. Mr. Chair, there was a little background noise. Representative Anderson.
So, Representative Nash, when it comes to sale of the liquor, how does it work when we have laws that say you can't sell past a certain point? So how would that work in the grocery store setting if you're open 24 hours? How does that work?
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in our store in our Wausau, Wisconsin location, we have a chained-off area where we sell spirits between the hours of 6 a.m. and midnight in Wisconsin. We rope off that area and sign it as such. Our registered are locked out from allowing the sale to happen at the lanes, as well as we patrol the area. We have security in the area as well to make sure that does not happen. That store is open 24 hours. The liquor department is not.
Thank you, Mr. Glade. Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Clem, just for clarification, I assume that all the hours of operation for sale of liquor apply to the food retailer as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct. There's nothing in this bill that provides an exemption for the statutory hours of sale that are prescribed in state law, and presumably the local ordinances for the regulating hours of sale would also be in effect.
Okay.
Representative Helferson. Oh, sorry, Representative Anderson, did you have something else?
Just a comment. I can wait till later, though.
Nope. Go ahead, Representative Anderson. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. As you know, I think that this is something that we're going to go to eventually in the state, and I appreciate you bringing this issue forward. I would probably not have it just limited to Minnesota products. I've traveled the nation and have seen plenty of grocery stores in West Coast, East Coast, where they do sell all these products. I do think, though, with the bill as it's drafted and the fact that you have it for Minnesota products, it's a great way to advertise Minnesota and the tourism that we have here in the state and promoting those local farmers that produce these products. So I appreciate your effort.
Representative Helton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. Who can ring up these sales per your bill? Is there any, can any teenager work in the register ring these sales up, or would an adult have to ring these sales up? How would that work?
Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, the same rules that apply to selling 3-2 beer on grocery stores will apply here, and my testifier will probably testify to the fact that you have to be able to sell legally in order to be the one operating the register. So nothing would change in that regard.
And Representative Halverson, to that point, I mean, that's something we're all going to figure out. I mean, you know, if this bill goes forward next year, the next legislature, the people that are on the Commerce Committee next year, we can figure that out and work with it at that point. Does that answer your question?
I guess I would like to hear from the testifier as well.
Please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, in our store in Wausau, Wisconsin, the 18 years old and older are able to sell to our customers that are 21 or older. The 16 and 17-year-old cashiers will have to call over a person that's holding the liquor license in the store to approve the sale. They're not allowed to sell to the customers. They don't even scan it. They don't ring it up. They do not slide it across the scanner until someone's over there to approve the sale.
Thank you, Mr. Blade. Representative Halverson.
And, Mr. Chair, how will you deal with issues of the responsibility and accountability for selling to somebody who may be impaired?
Mr. Blade or Representative Matt?
So in our liquor stores, as well as our supermarket in Wisconsin, alcohol training disallows us from selling to someone who appears to be impaired of any sort, and we go through compliance training to ensure that they are following those regs and rules. If you appear to be impaired, if you are a person that is of 21 years old with underage people or people we suspect to be underage, we ask for IDs for all the people in your party to ensure that the sale is going through to of-age folks.
Representative Halverson.
And, Mr. Chair, who's accountable if a sale to somebody who is impaired happens and an accident happens or they get pulled over and found out they were sold to with the impairment? Is that the employee? Does the employee bear some responsibility and some culpability legally, or is it simply the employer?
Mr. Boyd?
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, we had this situation in our liquor stores as well as our store in Wausau. Our policy as a company is that the employee that sells underage knowingly will be terminated. They will also receive a personal fine, I believe, from the municipality based on the area. The company is responsible as well. So the seller and the company that employs the seller are all responsible for the actions of selling to a potentially underage person and the consequences that come with that.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. Representative Helm?
Mr. Chair, I guess I think that we talk about selling hard liquor, wine and beer in a way that we only talk about the responsible users, and we only talk about it in terms of, you know, it might be somebody who needs wine to cook with. It might be somebody who's having a dinner party. But the fact is when you are in the business of selling intoxicating spirits, intoxicating liquors, you also are dealing with people with situations that can be dangerous for employees. And I think that we need to make sure that employees are protected in this situation. I worked in a liquor store in college and more than once had to confront intoxicated people and not sell to them. And if you don't sell to somebody, they're mad. And it can be a dangerous situation. It can be a situation for a teenager, even an 18, 19-year-old, an adult, that can be very difficult to manage. And so as we're talking about these laws, let us not only talk about the kind of romanticized way that people talk about using wine, beer, and spirits. And this is some, you know, I went home last night, and it's my husband's birthday, so we had cocktails, and life was great. But that's not what this business is all about. There's a lot of responsibility that goes into running these businesses, and a lot of responsibility gets put on employees. And these are going to be, in many cases, teenagers. And so we want to be sure that we're going to pass a law that's going to keep our employees safe and keep them away from liability as well. That's a big concern for me.
Thank you, Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for clarification, what happens for, like, dram shop liability, right? You serve to somebody who's over-intoxicated. The dram shop then, right, has responsibility if they go out and kill somebody. What happens if they sell to someone who is over, you know, who is intoxicated? They go out, they have an incident, someone's harmed. Does dram shop liability also transfer to other places as well or not?
Representative Nash?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, I would phone a friend to our legal counsel, but also, you know, this is being done now, and Ted's Fire may be able to answer that as to how they do that currently.
Well, Representative Nash and members, I think what we're doing here is having an informational hearing. We're not moving a bill today. If we are going to move a bill, we will address all these concerns. It's currently not legal for anybody that sells alcohol to sell to anybody that's impaired. We understand there could be issues with it, underage people working in grocery stores. These are all things that this committee and other committees are going to work on should this bill move forward next year. I think these are all good questions and valid concerns. With looking at the clock, we have a lot of people that want to speak in opposition to the bill, and I think we should get to those people. Having said that, are there any other questions immediately? Representative Cresha, did you? Representative Davids?
Well, I'll pass on what I was going to say, but I just think this bill, I know it's not moving today, but this would have to come to tax committee, so just let's keep that in mind.
Thank you, members. And with that, Mr. Wright, if you want to come down.
And Mr. Chair, as Mr. Wright is coming down, I will say to the committee members, you know, to your point, these are all things that if this were to be a bill next year, I'm happy to work on it with you, even if I'm the author. So you know that I've been very open in my history here, and if you have concerns, I'm happy to work with you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Mr. Reich, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Reich. I'm with Winthrop & Weinstein Law Firm. We represent the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, or DISCUS, the trade association comprised of the manufacturers of distilled spirits in the United States. We are testifying on behalf of DISCUS in opposition to House File 4152 today for the following reasons. First, as presently constructed in the bill, it only allows for the sale of spirits manufactured in Minnesota. We believe that this is unconstitutional and unconstitutionally infringes on interstate commerce, thus violating the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And to the degree that issue is rectified via amendment in the bill, and spirits of any origin are allowed for sale, then we would also believe that it will reduce selection to consumers of spirits. As many of you know, various spirits are undergoing a resurgence in interest and sales in the United States, and in fact, the world, consumers are buying and enjoying a wide variety of products, and Minnesota consumers have access to a wider array of different types of spirits than they have ever had before. In other states, most notably Tennessee, where laws have passed allowing grocery stores to sell spirits, we've seen the selection of spirits decrease dramatically. Traditional family-owned liquor stores have gone out of business, and grocery stores have not provided the selection that was previously available, as they are compelled to sell the most popular brands because they don't have the shelf space for 30 or 40 different kinds of spirits. In conclusion, as currently constituted, DISCUS opposes the legislation, but of course, as always, we look forward to working with the committee, the chair, and the author of the bill as the conversation continues.
Mr. Wright, thank you. Nice job. With that, Mr. Morrow from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Mr. Moore, we appreciate you having a little hustle coming down. We like that. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Art Morrow, State Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. So you've already talked about hours of sale. I'm not going to belabor that. Our other concern area is underage sales prevention. And we recommend, just based on what our colleagues tell me has been done in other states, that people who are underage not be able to sell alcohol, and then that will eliminate the temptation of them selling to peers or friends. So those are our two concern areas. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Very nice testimony. We appreciate it. And Ms. Schoenzeit, if you want to come down. And while you're coming down, I think you know, clearly this is an issue that should it move forward next year. There are a lot of issues that members have brought up here, and I think we're seeing some of the things that would have to be addressed. And with that, Ms. Schoenzeit, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you for having me. My name is Jennifer Schoenzeit. I own Zips Liquor Store in Minneapolis, which my father started in 1961. It's a family-owned business, and it's the only business that my family ever has had. I come to you today to oppose the legislation and explain that creating a special law to allow wine, beer, and spirits in grocery stores and convenience stores would impact our state in many ways and create winners and losers. Special laws for one group of retailers. Right now, any retailer can apply and receive a license to sell alcohol off-sale. This means that grocery stores and convenience stores can do this currently under Minnesota law. In fact, many have done so. Right now, there are approximately 135 grocery stores throughout the state that have applied and received licenses to sell alcohol. There are also service stations and drugstores that as well. These are include Target, Cub, Barley's, Costco. Any grocery store, gas station, and drugstore of any sizes and locations, including Julie's Convenience Store in Frost, Carl's Corner Market in Forest Lake, Bob's Corner Market in Boyville, Walgreens in Mankato, Jim's Market in Liquor in Candace, and many more. All of these are perfect examples of current Minnesota businesses selling alcohol under current law. Alcohol is sold in an adjoining premise that does not employ minors and segregate alcohol from other products. This new special exemption would provide food retailers a special law only for them, while everyone else, such as my family business, continue to sell under existing laws. I urge you to not create a special law for one category of retailers. They already can do this, and why do they want to do more? This also will devastate the small business. Every small business set up and invested in their business based upon uniform set of laws that apply to all applicants. Creating a special law only for food realtors will devastate small business. There are very few food realtors that are small businesses anymore. In the Twin Cities, food realtors is dominated by a handful of large business owners, by publicly traded companies similar. Many gas stations are owned by very few companies. Supermerica, BP, Holiday, Quick Trip are all large companies that are dominate. Again, if you remember one thing, these companies already can and complete under the same rules as all other alcohol realtors. Providing these companies with a unique set of rules will harm small business. In conclusion, on behalf of my family and employees, I urge you strongly to oppose this ill-advised, unnecessary legislation that solely is designed to enrich big business at the expense of small business. It is picking winners and losers and expanding alcohol, and it is unnecessary.
Ms. Schoenzeit, thank you. You always do a nice job testifying.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Mark Tetrow from Legacy Wine and Spirits. Mr. Chesick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Hoppe and committee members, Mark was unable to make it. He's short staff, so he couldn't make it. So I'll submit his testimony after the hearing. I'll send it off to Ms. Reynolds. Good morning. My name is Tony Chesick. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. I hear about the tremendous growth in the craft beer, spirits, and farm wineries that have all taken place under the current three-tiered system. Unprecedented growth in these three industries have happened under current law, and there needs to be changes. 134 and growing grocery stores have complied with state law and have built liquor stores that are in the same building but only a door away. Again, what's flawed with the current system? Countless and growing convenience stores have full off-premise licenses that are in the same building but only a door away. Again, what's wrong with the current system? The proponents discuss staying competitive in today's market. What community is screaming because their liquor store purchases and selections are being underserviced? What customer is complaining because alcohol is difficult to find? Customers now have 7 days and 91 hours a week to buy their alcohol. By the way, Minnesota retailers have been recognized by major and minor manufacturers for having some of the best selection of alcohol in the world. Sacrificing all that because large corporations want to saturate all that business and in the end offer less of a selection and choice? The Distilled Spirits Council of the United States has discussed that. Yes, you may hear rumors that 3.2 is going away. If you know that, could you please tell me and the beer wholesalers? Because we haven't been told that. If the grocery stores are surviving and flourishing by selling an average of 3.7 cases of 3.2 beer weekly to date, why is there a need to change state law? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chesick. With that, I think our final testifier on the other side of the hill, Mr. Holmer, the mayor of Thief River Falls. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Brian Holmer. I'm the mayor of Thief River Falls. I've been sent down here 300 miles because this is a concern to our community. I've talked to other mayors from Edina to Roseau to War Road throughout the state, and they have similar circumstances we're in. We have an enterprise in Thief River Falls, a Muni liquor store, since 1947. That's 71 years. During my elected term, elected in 2015, we've transferred $1.7 million to our general fund. Even last year, with a 7% decrease in our sales, we still provided to our under 10,000 population 17% of a property tax buy-down. So who's going to make up the difference? Additional community investments are the Bull Ride, River Fest, Deer Hunters Association, Volunteer Firemen, Education Foundation, after prom parties. That's not the concern here. Concern here is that this is a controlled substance that belongs inside of a brick-and-mortar building separated from groceries and our youth. Our employees at our municipal liquor store receive beverage alcohol training. This is to identify underage drinkers, fake IDs, falsifying their age, and also refusal of service, not only to intoxicated people, but people that might be bringing an underage drinker into the municipal liquor store. We have a policy that if you bring someone underage in, you're not going to get sold that service, and you're not going to be sold the service for the remainder of that day. We are strongly on within our liquor law compliance. We work with our local law enforcement officials, and they, too, have a feel the need to making sure that we still control this substance. I think grocery stores are for milk and orange juice and eggs, and opening up to alcohol to grocery stores is a real bad idea. With all due respect, if this does happen to go through and we lose our municipal liquor store, I will be letting our constituents know what you have done to us as far as our property tax increase. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much. Nice job. Mr. Pomeroy. Oh, Representative Loon.
I'm sorry. The mayor, I had a question for you.
Sorry, I didn't see Representative Loon had her hand up.
Sorry to make you mad. Just a question. So do your grocery stores currently sell 3.2 beer?
They have 3.2 liquor, yes.
Okay, so they do sell intoxicating substance in your grocery stores right now?
Yeah, okay. Just 3.32 liquor.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Mr. Pomeroy, welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Andy Pomeroy, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Distillers Guild. We're an industry association of craft spirits distilleries. Our members come from all over Minnesota, from Far North Spirits in Halleck, Minnesota, to Rock Filter Distillery down in Spring Grove, which I believe is Representative David's nine-man football champion, the Lions. Is that true, Mr. Chair? That's right. Anyway, we turn Minnesota-grown grain and Minnesota clean water into some of the best spirits on the planet. And, you know, we provide Minnesota consumers with a better tasting and locally produced alternative to the large national brands of spirits that we're all familiar with. The distilling industry in Minnesota has not grown as rapidly as the beer industry, and it probably never will. The regulatory framework for distilleries, as well as just the basic economics of distilling, necessitate that a distillery must sell into distribution. There's just no way for us to make a profit with our cocktail rooms and on-site off-sale alone. So that's why we appreciate the portion of Representative Nash's bill that would limit food retailer spirit sales to Minnesota-made spirits small manufacturers. This will help Minnesota-based businesses ensure that Minnesota consumers come face-to-face with our products and not just those large national brands that, as Mr. Reich pointed out, do tend to take up space in other states that allow sales in grocery and convenience stores. So in Minnesota, we all live within the regulatory framework that you established for us. Minnesota's got a quite rigid three-tier system that you're all familiar with. And when exceptions to that system are created, you tend to create an offsetting requirement or limit to that exception. And as such, we feel it's entirely appropriate that if an exception to the traditional retail end of the three-tier system is created, that there be some strings attached to that exception as well. So requiring grocery and convenience stores to sell Minnesota-made spirits from micro-distilleries and wineries, we believe is a fair requirement to place on a retail establishment that a traditional liquor store does not have to comply with. So with that, I'll just thank you for your time and your attention to this sort of sub-issue within the debate, and just let you know that we appreciate any work that you do to support Minnesota's small manufacturers.
Thank you, Mr. Pomeroy. Representative Krishna?
Yep, that completes the real quickly. Mr. Pomeroy, obviously you've spent more time researching this. Since I've been in legislature, there's definitely a sense of direction with alcohol and all the regulatory framework. What do you see going forward? Where is this all going to go, or does it end? You know, we caucus and talk about next thing, and I would just be curious to get your take on that.
Sure. I know, you know, this committee and this legislature, the House anyway, passed some legislation that we supported last year, allow some additional flexibility on bottle sales for small micro distilleries. Those are the kind of issues that we're focused on. I think when it comes to this particular issue, I think for our organization, our sort of overall view on it sort of depends on what other pieces are put in place. And we're looking for partners that want to work with us to come up with an overall system that works, that grows Minnesota-based businesses, that provides consumers choice. As I sort of briefly mentioned Mr. Reich's comments earlier, we are concerned about the variety and the selection on store shelves. We're concerned about market consolidation. There's a lot of different issues that come into play and don't always fit in the exact same bucket on this particular issue. So we think there's some changes that need to be made broader than just this issue, if this issue is even one that the legislature decides to go for.
Thank you, Mr. Pomeroy. Representative Krishna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank my other colleague, Representative Krishna, for his comments as well. sorry. I'll explain to you later. just a couple comments as I'm listening, and I know we've, as you said, it's just an informational meeting, but a couple of things. The 3-2 issue is going to be real, and we have to be proactive with that, as well as the fact that landscape is changing. We may not like this. We may not like what the effects are, but I believe liquor stores, grocery stores, they're all feeling the pinch of Amazon's and other moving down. The market's just changing and in flux. So one comment I did hear that I wanted to address was that if the 3-2 market is going away, we'd like to hear it. In Utah, in the Salt Lake Times, Anheuser-Busch and Miller's and Coors have said if this doesn't change, they're going to start scaling back 3-2. That's happening in the market. Those market indicators are there. And they may not be here today, but Mr. Chair, and with the overall topic of commerce, I think it behooves us to look at commerce in general. And we see lots of market forces happening here. I agree with some of the comments of Chair Davids, but I also know that things are going to change. And I think that by you having this informational hearing and signaling, we have to get this policy right in the conditions that are changing. That's more important than saying we just have to start drawing roadblocks. So this market's changing.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Anderson. Thank you. And with that, Mr. Funk, I apologize. Please identify yourself. I sometimes lose my little scribblings here, and I missed you on the list of people to testify. Mr. Funk from Lunds and Byerly.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on support of HF 4152. I'm Kurt Funk, Vice President for Lunds and Byerly. We own and operate 26 stores in the Twin Cities. We employ 4,000 employees across three different unions, and it's interesting hearing your conversation around the optics of a mom-and-pop retailer. In our perspective, we are a mom-and-pop retailer at 26 stores. We weigh in at a whopping $650 million in annual sales. Most grocery retailers, if they incurred a 12 to 15% hit to their top-line sales, would actually go out of business, kind of an unknown fact. So when we're competing with folks like Amazon, who buy an organization like Whole Foods, 450-plus stores, and the debate is whether or not they're going to actually run them as grocery stores or use those as distribution centers, it's frightening out there. So I would ask you to think about your optics on what a small mom-and-pop retailer actually looks like. We spend something in the neighborhood of $18 to $20 million a year on CapEx in the Twin Cities. That money is all typically done by union labor. This year we're opening a new store in White Bear Lake. We'll spend $15 million. That doesn't include the property to open that store. Again, a lot of that work will be completed by union labor. So our investments back into the community, back into our stores, and back into driving the economy is pretty significant. talk to you about Sunday sales. Thank you very much for passing Sunday sales. But what I want you to understand about Sunday sales is our sales increase from that is 3.55% on a year-to-date basis since July. We needed 2.6% just to break even on labor. It wasn't about increasing sales. That was a big driver for that. It's what our customers wanted and demanded from us, was to be able to buy products on Sunday. So thank you for doing that. But understand that the big windfall that the grocery channel got is not as big as anybody thinks it is. I want to speak to the idea of the carting of folks. So we have a very rigid policy as it pertains to, it's a controlled substance, right? So if you come into your store, our store, and you're 85 years old, guess what? You're going to get carted. We're going to run that through an electronic device, and if it doesn't pass, we will not make that sale to you. We do have instances where the sale has been overridden. Unfortunately, we don't have 21-year track record of not having an issue. We have had instances where the employee didn't trust the system and hand-keyed it. We've gone back. We've taken a statement from that employee. We've looked at the cameras to see what they did. We looked at the transaction. Typically, if the employee is, in fact, at fault, we have to take the action necessary. There's a penalty that's involved, loss of job, loss of pay, a lot of other things. So we take safety very, very easy, very, very, it's very important to us. Excuse me for a minute. Consumer demands, again, talked a lot about that. Consumers are shifting all the time. There were $1,800 stores that opened up in the U.S. last year. These are all folks that are out there taking a piece of the business from the grocery retailer. So think about that 15%. Think about the impact. It doesn't take much to give up 15% of your business. A road closure can shut down a retailer if it's gone on for long enough. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Funk. Any questions? Members, I think we're normally an afternoon committee. I didn't think there'd be this many questions this early in the morning, but clearly it's a topic that members have interest in. Thank you to everybody that testified for and against the bill. And with that, Representative Nash, Representative Precia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one thing I wanted to ask, we mentioned convenience stores and grocery stores, but what we haven't done, Representative Nash, how does this affect bait stores, VFWs, Legions? I mean, this is a lot more wider problem. Is that correct?
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kusha, yes, it does. And, you know, that is something that we need to address moving forward. And, you know, members, this is an information hearing, and I'm listening to everything that you're saying. If I'm the author next year, if there's even a bill next year, these are all things that we can take up. These are all things that we can talk about moving forward here in committee and all the other committees of jurisdiction. But I just want to conclude by saying that there's a presumption that we're out to harm people, that we're out to harm businesses. That's not the case. That's not the case. What we're trying to do is to be reactive to what the consumers are telling us and still make sure that we're reacting to the needs of the existing businesses that populate our communities, because they're our neighbors as well. So I just think that's a little bit of a false narrative that I wanted to make sure that I addressed as I concluded in saying thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nash. Thank you, members. Thank you again to everybody that spoke on the bill. And with that, members, it's almost 10 o'clock. We are in session at 10. So if it's an informational hearing, if people want to leave and go to the floor, please do. I'm going to stay, and we're going to proceed with the next bill, because I don't want to have people come back later this afternoon or evening or whenever we might get done. So with that, members, thank you, and we'll get on to the next bill. Representative Fenton, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from our last meeting?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I moved the minutes from May 14th.
Thank you. Representative Fenton moves the minutes from the May 14th meeting. Any comments, concerns, questions? Seeing none, those in favor of the approval of the adoption of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. And with that, we will jump into the next bill, which is my bill. I'm going to stay here, House File 4481, and we'll get right into testifiers. Dr. Dahl, if you want to come down, and please proceed whenever you're ready. Dr. Dahl, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Wayne Dahl. I'm a chiropractor for 42 years in Minnesota, and I represent the 600 or so members of the Doctors Lodge Network, who are the primary treaters of no-fault crash injury victims. We've had two events that have occurred in the last few years that make a mockery of the very purpose of the No-Fault Act, which is to assure prompt payment to doctors who treat no-fault crash victims. And this promise is what doctors rely upon so that they'll treat patients. We had a decision in Summa versus American Family this last year that turned the date of loss on its head. In other words, if I were to ask anyone in this room, when is the date of loss in an auto accident, I believe there are very few people here who could tell you. And I've done a survey of that, and I know that to be the case. Most people would say the date of loss is the date of the accident. That's not the case any longer. The Minnesota Supreme Court asked for your guidance on this because this decision was, they questioned their own decision and their interpretation of the law, and that's why they asked for your guidance. I don't think that happens very often. But what happens now is the date of loss is now determined to be the date that the bill is received by the insurance company. So that had two effects. One, it nullified all of the doctor's receivables. In other words, the doctors who treated the patients based on that promise now all of a sudden have no way to get paid, and all of their receivables were wiped out. Okay, and it further made it so that the doctors have to change the way they do business. And I think everyone here knows when you go to a doctor's office, a clinic, a hospital, the first thing that happens is you go in and you do the paperwork. Okay, and you do the paperwork and then you see the doctor. Well, part of that paperwork is the assignment of benefits. And the assignment of benefits is the only right that the doctor has to get paid. Well, if the accident or the date of loss is when the patient, when their bill reaches the insurance company, now the doctor has to call the patient up and say, oh, come on back in and assign the benefits, because we treated you before the date of loss. So that makes it a very cumbersome, nearly impossible event. So that had an it's had an effect on doctors even wanting to treat no-fault crash victims, because they have no assurance that the promise of the no-fault law for prompt payment is any good. And there are carriers out there who I consider to be outliers who absolutely don't pay your bill. Matter of fact, when you call them up to say, how come you haven't paid my bill, they go, we don't have to talk to you. You don't have any rights because your assignment of benefits is no good. Who are you? Talk to the attorney. We don't have any obligation to you. You just treated the patient. The second thing that happened was that the No-Fault Act says the only remedy that there is for any kind of claim that's denied is to go to arbitration. That's the only, you have one remedy, arbitration. Well, the No-Fault Rules Committee decided that only the insured, which is the patient, can go to arbitration. Well, that's a pretty daunting thing for a lot of patients. You know, they go and get, you know, they paid for their insurance policy, and they expect when they had their crash that their bills were going to get paid. Now all of a sudden their bills aren't paid for who knows how many different reasons insurance companies dig up to not pay the bill. And now the burden is on the patient to go and arbitrate their own bill. They don't know what to do, how to do it. What happens if the patient dies after you treat the patient? What happens if the patient moves out of state? What happens if the patient just doesn't care if the doctor's bill gets paid? So now all of a sudden we have another situation where the promise of prompt payment has no meaning. And the doctor works on the crash victims, hoping that he's going to get paid, and he has no assurance that that's the case. So that was a decision by the Supreme Court Rules Committee, and also the American Arbitration Association refuses to arbitrate these bills. So all of a sudden there is no remedy for the doctor to get paid. Well, the Minnesota Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says that it's unconstitutional to not have a remedy to get paid. And doctors do not have any remedy. They treat the patients, and there's no remedy other than suing the patient. Doctors don't like to sue their patients. That's not in their nature. They're healing people. They want to take care of people. They don't want to sue their patients. If the promise of prompt payment was good, this wouldn't be an issue. So the bill that we've proposed corrects these problems by making the date of loss the date of the crash, which is what everybody has believed it to be for the last, since the inception of the No Fault Act. Always. And if I asked any of you here, what's the date of loss? You're all going to say the date of the crash. Nobody's going to say when the insurance company gets the bill. So that's between that we're saying basically, so the Supreme Court has asked for your guidance, okay, with respect to the date of loss and with respect to the ability to arbitrate a bill in the doctor's own name where he can handle his own arbitration. That's demanded by the Constitution that the doctor has a remedy. Any questions?
Dr. Dahl, we have a question. Representative?
Real quickly, 36 years in insurance, the date of loss is the date of the crash, period. The question, though, for the testifier is, when you treat a patient, does the billed for amount, is that affected by who's paying the bill? Or do you charge the same amount, whether it's insurance coverage, network, in-network, or a private pay?
Dr. Dahl.
The HICPA 1500 form at the top of it says, is this an automotive-related accident? If it is, we have to bill it under the No Fault Act, otherwise it's insurance fraud. And by the way, I respect your 36 years. However, I don't think you're up to date on the SUMA versus American Family, because they determined the date of loss is when the insurance company receives the bill. It's not the crash, even though when a crash victim fills out his application for benefits and they ask for the date of loss, you and everyone else knows that that is the date of the crash. Mm-hmm. So but when it comes to paying, it's the date when the insurance company receives the bill.
But Representative Lunan.
But back to the question, do you bill different amounts based on who is going to pay?
No, absolutely not. That would be absolutely improper.
Dr. Dahl, thank you very much. We need to get members moving here, so we'll have Dr. Sawyer. If you want to come down, we appreciate it. Bob, do you want to go up? Bob, Mr. Johnson, if you want to come up at the same time. Dr. Sawyer, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Chuck Sawyer. I'm a chiropractic doctor, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. On behalf of many of our members, the MCA supports the concepts included in House File 4481 that address the ability of a healthcare provider to receive payment for services provided through the arbitration process when that becomes necessary, and to make certain that an assignment of benefits given by the patient to a healthcare provider before services are provided is enforceable under the no-fault system. The approach taken in this bill is the first step, we believe, in addressing these important issues, and we look forward to working with interested stakeholders during the legislative interim to find an acceptable and meaningful approach. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Sawyer, thank you very much. Mr. Johnson, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be very, very brief, Mr. Chairman. I represent companies that write a majority of the auto insurance sold in the state. We disagree very strongly with the bill, House File 4481, and the dramatic changes that it would bring about from how the system has operated since No Fault was passed in 1974. And I'm not going to get into too many details. We can save that for another time. But this bill really is trying to legitimize a business practice that has been rejected by every court that has heard it in Minnesota, by the Court of Appeals, by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and other litigations. It's been rejected on the wording of the no-fault law as it stands today, and on 50 years of case law in Minnesota dealing with the enforceability of anti-assignment provisions or clauses in contracts. And, Mr. Chairman, we'll get into that, I guess, at a later date. But with that change, and frankly, there's very sound public policy reasons, in addition to the wording of the statutes, as to why the court was correct in rejecting that business practice of putting the provider in charge of the claim. That's a bad idea. It's a bad idea to put a provider in charge of the claim. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I mean, just for instance, if you look at the bill and you look at Section 2, Subdivision 1, and you look at the first sentence, the new language directly contradicts what the Minnesota no-fault law has said since the day it was passed. And the sentence says that loss accrues not when the injury occurs, but as the medical expenses is incurred. That's what the law says. So the reason the courts rejected the business practice is because the statute says exactly what it does, and the business practice was contrary to the way the law is written. So there's not any ambiguity. We're talking about unanimous summary judgment decisions that rejected it. Mr. Chairman, I won't get into it, but I'll just, in closing, just comment that some of the sound public policy reasons of not having a provider in charge of it is the fraud issues. I don't think this committee has heard a presentation from our Commerce Department Fraud Bureau on the Operation Backcracker that's currently underway with trials going on against healthcare providers. And these are cases that are criminally charged out by the FBI, the U.S. Attorney, and the Fraud Bureau, multiple providers, chiropractors with their runners, for tens of millions of dollars of no-fault medical fraud. And, Mr. Chairman, we don't want those costs on consumers. The trials that have been held to date have all been found guilty on all counts. All counts. There's more trials coming. I think the charge is total. I don't have the press release with me. It's $30 or $40 or $50 million the consumer should not be paying. And so, Mr. Chairman, it's a mistake to put the provider in charge of it. This statute has remedies. This statute has provisions. We have interest penalties. I don't think the evidence is simply not there to document that providers are not being paid for the services that they rendered, being reimbursed. This is a reimbursement system with high interest penalties. So, Mr. Chairman, I think we look forward to the future hearings. We look forward to this committee, the Civil Law Committee, that will get into the anti-assignment cases and issues. We have an attorney, Mr. Matthew Lutz, here that's intimately familiar with all of the litigation. If you, Mr. Chairman, or anybody wants to hear about any of the details, this may not be the right place for that, but we're happy to engage in the discussion of every part of this bill. And over the interim, with this whole issue about the payment of providers and who should be in charge of the claim, if there's an auto accident injury and the individual is being treated, we want them to get the care that they need, you know, so that they get whole and well. So, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to engage in any real questioning because, as we know, our session started, but. Since I've been at the legislature, there has been constant attacks on no-fault insurance and attempts to eliminate no-fault insurance. And ultimately, I think this committee wants to make sure that people who need care get care. and that the people who provide the care get paid, and that if there's fraud in the system, we prosecute the fraud and we make certain that it doesn't happen. And so I understand that this bill may be subject to some conversations over the interim, but I think everybody believes that if someone is injured and someone legitimately is treated, that the people who provide that treatment should get paid.
Thank you, Representative. Sir, did you want to make a comment?
No, I'll just identify myself for the record. Again, my name is Matthew Lutz, L-U-T-Z. I'm in-house litigation counsel for American Family Insurance, and I successfully obtained the Supreme Court decision that this bill attempts to overturn, as well as the underlying Court of Appeals decision, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court, as well as a related district court opinion from the Honorable Frank McGill from the Hennepin County District Court that recently dismissed a lawsuit that SUMA had brought against American Family on the basis of its alleged UCC liens.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lutz. Thank you to everybody that spoke for and against the bill, and thank you, members. And with that, we are adjourned.